from a real analog world and an analog way of thinking, and also in terms of signal routing, was really, really a big deal when I switched over to a DAW eventually. And for a long time, I was sort of a hybrid doing both, because for me, it was a big transition. And I know that a lot of cats are coming into this like saying, you know, analog tape and mixing consoles, like, you know, what do you mean? You know, we're in a DAW world, and a lot of people come into it in that sort of, you know, paradigm. But I got to say, for me as well, like Big Al said, that was a big deal. That was a big deal.
Yeah, for me, that would be the same as Big Al and Slough. But the next thing for me, to not repeat what they just said, was when I started using MIDI a lot more often, as well as virtual instruments. That was a really big step for being able to work quicker and get excellent sounds right inside of that digital world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think for me it was as simple as getting a good mic. I started on the little stick mic that you plug into the little 1/8-inch jack on your sound card, and I thought I was hot stuff. And then the day I had a condenser, and then I asked the guy at the store if I could plug it into that same 1/8-inch jack, and I did not get a good response from him. he wasn't too kind, but now we're here. So, well, cool. Well, I think I'm just scrolling through some of these questions here. One of the biggest issues, and obviously I face this, and I mean, everybody does, even whether you're in a home studio or in a professional studio, you'll face this at some point, but obviously noise is a big issue. So what kind of, do you guys have any tricks and things that you use to cut down on noise? Do you use some sort of, just capture the noise and get rid of it later with something else? Or do you have some cool contraptions you've built? Or what do you do in that regard?
Well, just keeping my kids out of the room in the first place definitely cuts down on the noise.
You mean just sort of like ambient noise and stuff? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for a lot of us, the computer's in the same room, so you've got hard drive noise and computer noise, AC noise, all those types of things.
Mm. I have to say, when I started out, you know, I for the first couple of years, I was working out of home, and so, you know, I did not have the luxury of, you know, any kind of soundproofing or anything like that. And at the time, I was recording some bands just in the living room. And I got some moving blankets from a company called MarkerTech up in Connecticut. And they had these moving blankets for, like, I don't know, about $12 a piece or something. Just these large quilts. I got a bunch of those and, like, literally hammered them onto the windows just to cut down a little bit on sort of you know, extraneous noise. But, you know, for the most part, it was kind of a little bit more close miking rather than any sort of room. I just pretty much tried to eliminate any kind of room noise that I could with, you know, cardioid patterns and just, you know, trying to get as hot a signal as I could, because at the time when I started out, I was doing like multi-track cassette recording, so your dynamic range wasn't all that great. And I think all of that kind of stuff paid off later. You know, I mean, the better you get at that stuff with, you know, in other words, the better you get at getting the best you can out of cheaper gear, the better off you can be later on when you sort of step up to the next level and you think, oh, this is easier. Because now, you know, you're dealing with taking levels on something that has a 24-bit dynamic range, and you think, oh, the hell, I'll give myself 20 dB of headroom. There was no 20 dB of headroom when I started out, you know? So it's a different world again.
You know, I did a lot of the same things Slough's talking about, and also, when I decided to upgrade my one Apple G4, I went to an iMac, which is a, you know, basically a fanless, noise-free computer, which really cut down the noise in the studio and having to worry about dealing with it, because I was using expanders to deal with it, which really helps. to you know, cut the noise during tracking, but it's not always optimum. So cutting out noise in the room, and if you have, you know, a PC or some other computer, you can always get products like, oh, Arlex Sheet Block, and there's lots of things you can do to your computer to help insulate it and keep the sound inside of it without causing it to overheat by blocking the airflow. But, I mean, there's anything from more bigger, higher volume, more silent fans you can put on the CPU to changing it to water cooling to physical insulation on the inside, because we all have to deal with the computer one way or another, and they can be your friend or your horrible enemy when it comes to noise.
Yeah. Absolutely. Any other noise fighting tricks?
Well, I have to say that I did a segment on the home recording show a couple weeks ago about using the null and the mic, and I think Slav touched on that earlier, using the, you know, cardioid patterns and things like that that will reject a lot of noise coming from the other end of your sound source, and that has helped dramatically.
My dad, you could
and
also
57 always takes care of that.
With that miking technique, you know, so if, like Jesse and Slaw are talking about close miking, and you can also very cheaply build some gobos.
That's what I was going to bring up.
And so I'll toss that over to Ryan and let him take the ball on that then.
Yeah, I just built one about 3 weeks ago, and I went on to a website called FreeCycle, or you go to Craigslist Free. I got a bunch of materials that someone has gotten rid of because of a remodel. They were done. So a couple sheets of drywall, build a little frame, stuff it with insulation, put a nice cover on the front. You can make a real nice gobo. I put it up on wheels, and now I have like a 6 foot by 3.5 foot gobo on wheels. One side I use plywood, the other side is just the open insulation with a nice breathable fabric on the front. That will give you a tremendous amount of separation from one side to the next. And I use the plywood on the one side, so I would have one reflective side if I want it. If I want that to go away, then right back to furniture blankets, throw it right over the top. And even with that, I still use furniture blankets over mic stands. I'll tee them off, throw a furniture pad over the top. They're fantastic for isolation, and at $12 a pop, you can't beat it.
It's a great idea. I think I've found, with kind of going back to what Slaw was saying, is sometimes with, especially when you're trying to stereo mic a guitar or something and using condenser mics, they're just so sensitive that it almost becomes impossible to get to not pick up some of the room. But yeah, getting them as close as you can without completely killing the sound with proximity effect and everything. I found that works fairly well, that sacrifice a little bit of what, ideally it'd sound great if I could put them a foot away, but that just doesn't, there's too much noise to make that workable in a mix, but can usually wrangle the low end that comes up with miking things so closely, but it's definitely a kind of a give and take thing.
Obviously the best thing is try to get your room as quiet as possible.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you have a mic that has a low-end filter, you can, because a lot of the problems that people have are probably low-frequency noise. So if you're able to roll that off, I think that'll go a long way, especially since a lot of the instruments that people are recording probably aren't the quietest instruments in a home studio. So
yeah, and especially over, you know, 10, 12 tracks of the same thing building up, as much as you can get rid from the get-go, definitely would help out a lot.
In some ways,
yeah, that low end roll off is a great trick to use.
In some ways, I don't care about the noise too much. Like, my room is pretty quiet. Like, I can do acoustic guitars in here, no problem. But I do have baffles. I have blankets. My computer is silent. Just by the length that I went through to actually design a computer that is silent. And then I made sure that my gear is up to the task. So it's not, you know, they're not cheap pieces of equipment that have their own noise. Like, my main preamp has like absolutely no noise. So I know it's not that if there's a problem. And if I do have noise, if I get tracks from other people, then Isotope RX is just a miracle.
There's some voodoo going on with Isotope for sure. It's very cool.
And there is such a thing as good noise. Not all noise is bad. So let's not try to kill all noise, just the noise that you don't want in your track.
Yeah, and I found that the noise isn't, if it's not just a, you know, just an acoustic guitar and a vocal or something, but it's a fairly full mix, by the time you've got everything in the song, it almost becomes a non-issue. Except for maybe just the fade out at the end when you can hear it kind of come back to life, but
right. But even there are some people who just, yeah, I mean, like we all know that the performance trumps everything. And,
absolutely.
You know, you certainly hear stories of, like I remember reading an interview with the Glenn Ballard when he was producing Alanis Morissette's, first album. They did something where he was just sitting on the floor with electric guitar plugged in, sort of direct, and she was standing there singing, and they did the song. And then later, she left, you know, they did the whole thing. And then he realized that, you know, there was like buzz on the guitar and stuff like that. And he's like, you know, I'm just going to redo this. And he redoes it. And he thinks he just totally nails it, like does it exactly the same way. She comes back the next day and she's listening to it. And she's just like, whoa, what happened? You know, this doesn't sound right. What happened? And he explained that he redid the guitar. She's like, oh, no way. You gotta use the original because it feels better. And he's like, but there's noise on it. She says, so what? I mean, when they recorded You Ought to Know, same thing. We're talking distortion, all right, so it's not noise. But still, it's an unwanted or, say, what everybody would consider an undesirable artifact. I mean, he set her levels, and then she, like, totally pounded, you ought to know, and it totally overloaded the preamp. And so he was like, oh crap. And she's like, oh, you know, I'm not doing that again. He's like, she's like, no way, that's it, I'm not doing, I can't do that performance again. That's
nailed,
that's a
done
deal. Exactly. And you know, so it's like sometimes it's honest. And like, you know, some noise, I mean, look,
that's exactly it.
You have all kinds of trends, you know, in the music industry. And there are times when people say, oh, well, something sounds overproduced and it's too clean. You know, I mean, now, well, there was, of course, you know, the garage band sort of, you know, phase. And now, I mean, it seems to me like there's a lot of stuff, especially coming out of like Brooklyn, you know, where things are just like noisy as hell. But nobody cares because that's the vibe. That's the performance. So I mean,
feel is
believe
so
me,
good.
I appreciate clean sounds. Believe me. Don't get me wrong. I mean, that's what I strive for. but you know, like sometimes it just doesn't matter.
Oh, there's so many great live recordings, and there's so much bleed and stuff, and it just doesn't matter. Like,
right?
You know, you can't isolate all the instruments live. But there's so many like live concert performances or live from floor performances where there's bleed, but it doesn't matter at all. So,
right. And that is a huge part of the sound sometimes. I mean, there are recordings. I can't remember at this point who the engineer was. There was a particular recording, and I wish I could remember what it was. But somebody asked the engineer, wow, what mics did you use on the drums? They used zero. All of the drum sound was just bleeding into Omni mics in the room. They used no mics on the drums, and they sounded fantastic because it was just the whole recording. You have to take it, you know, as a whole. And I realize that today, you know, this probably doesn't apply to most recordings. Most people are like overdubbing, you know, drums over some kind of pre-produced, you know, scratch tracks and stuff like that. But you know, again, it all goes back to, you know, taking the thing as a whole, you know, for lack of a better word, holistic. I'm putting little quotes up in the air that you can't see. Taking a holistic approach to the recording, you know. So,
well, if you like the Motown sound, that was all just a stereo pair of mics in the room for everybody. The entire band.
Yeah.
And I love that sound. I still try to get that sound.
It's great.
You definitely do run into the like you said, Slough, if you're overdubbing everything, you end up having to manufacture somehow the energy that you would have had capturing a band that's really locked in and tight. You have to, it can still sound good, but man, sometimes as cool as it is to have everything clean and by itself, just the lack of energy that can sometimes happen.
Well, and there's certainly no bleed in an overdub unless you get a little bit through the headphones. So you're not getting that whole live band with open mics feel at all. It's the ultimate in separation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, it separates it to the degree that it disjoins things. And you'll have, people essentially doing parts. And let's assume that we have different people. It's not the same person doing all of the parts, because that's a whole different story again. But, you know, I've been in situations where people have played to a scratch track of something, and they play it, let's say, at a moderate volume. And then let's say another instrument is overdubbed. And now, of course, or let's say the drums are overdubbed. Well, now that track sounds like the drummer's like going at it, and that original take on the guitar is not, it's not commensurate to the drum performance. In a correlating way, you have a vocalist who's doing a performance, and they're singing like this. They're singing quietly. Meanwhile, if they were in the room with the drummer, they'd have to belt to be heard. And so you get these different qualities of performance. And so, and I'm sorry, I'm digressing. I'm going on to a different subject in terms of just, the idea of multi-tracking, as opposed to having a live band in a room. That's a whole different subject. I'm sorry.
That's a good point, though.
But it does have to, it does influence the sound, the overall sound of things. By definition, it does.
Very cool. And one of the attendees, Tom, made a point that, you listen to the multi-tracks of, Superstition or something. I think that song did fairly well for itself. And, there's bleed all over the place, and it's great.
Did anybody here download the all the Peter Gabriel tracks for that mix contest?
No, where was that at?
Yeah. Oh, this was last... Yeah, maybe even two years ago.
It's a couple years ago.
Shock the Monkey.
Talk about when you get to hear them separately. Talk about noise and bleed. It's just it made you think like, wow, if I was doing this, I wouldn't even accept this.
Yeah, and that's a clean sounding mix.
Yeah, when it was same thing. When it's done, sounds great.
Right.
But he's breathing and hawking a loogie half the time, it sounded like. But it's all there.
That's my sound.
That's right.
Sure.
Very cool.
I think that was realworldonline.com, something like that.
Yeah, I'm looking it up, too.
John always comes through with the URL.
I remember things that are pretty useful like that all the time. Like, I need to remember that like 5 years later.
Can't remember the bus schedule, but can remember where Shock the Monkey was 2 years ago.
It'll come in handy when there's the studio edition of Jeopardy.
Yeah.
That was supposed to be a secret. Okay, I'm seeing a couple questions here. One thing a lot of folks ask about is effects, and particularly reverb. When I get some mixes from folks who are just starting out, it seems like they have an affair with reverb because it's just everywhere. So what are some reverb pearls of wisdom as far as how much should you use? What should you use? A bunch of different reverbs? Only one?
And use a little less. That's
use,
it.
Use a little.
Yeah, I'm going
back
through that
away
with
from
one
the
client.
Wet control.
I've noticed that with a lot of young people starting off with DAWs, they just go crazy with the reverb, and it really does get out of control. And it's not the best thing all the time. A little bit goes a long way, and that's something to remember right from the beginning.
Yeah, a little does go a long way, and yes, people when they first start out, they sort of they get enamored with that reverb sound because it's something that they've never had before. They haven't had the control over before. And you also get that with singers too. And you have singers who, oh, could you add more reverb? Could you add more reverb? I always try to add as little as I think I can get away with, and then I take off a little bit too, and just add a little bit less, because and it goes to style too. You know, there were phases. You know, it goes in waves. You know, there are phases where people are recording with reverb, like in the 80s, of course, and then you have these like no reverb albums that are just totally dry, which we had in the 70s too. You know, you listen to Crosby, Stills, and Nash. You know, Our House. You know, there's like no reverb on that album. You know, and then you get again in the 80s these bands that just went nuts with reverb because it was stylish, you know. And I don't know where we're at now exactly. I think now we're sort of more into ambience, but not necessarily reverb right now. People are doing very ambient recordings, but reverb, yeah, just use as little as you can.
I'm liking a little bit of stereo delay, just short stereo delay.
There you go. Yeah, that's a trend now. Delays rather than reverb. Yep.
Or blended together.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, I think one of the big problems that a lot of people who are starting out might have with reverb is that they're putting reverb separately on each track, and then when they go into their output, they're also adding reverb to, you know, the master. So Wow. You're getting, you know, like a really, really wet sound and likely different reverbs that are not well matched, not suited to each other, definitely. So I think maybe people just need to think about how they're routing their reverb and perhaps try to, you know, have one reverb. Like, basically, there's so much power that people have with their processing power right these days that they can have separate reverb units on every track. But, you know, back when I started, I pretty much maxed it out right away and had core overload problems. So, you know, having bussing it out to one track and sort of, you know, only having a little bit of reverb sent out through, ascend perhaps could help.
Yeah. I rarely need any more than two reverbs on a typical mix. One for drums, one for everything else.
It's kind of how I do it too, for the most part.
I tend to use normally three if I'm using reverb. We've got one on the drums specifically, actually maybe one or two on the drums, one specifically on snare, and then one on everything else if necessary, and then musical instruments of any type, and then a separate one on the vocal. But that's about it. And in each case, it's like the tiniest amount of reverb on any one of those elements.
But I think if you have a reverb problem, then you should only use one for a while.
Seek help.
You're not allowed to have more than one reverb in your session.
Well, I think it's critical to learn how to bus tracks to a reverb.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're starting out, that's what you got to be able to master right off the bat. Because otherwise, if you don't have that down, then you're just going to have all kinds of reverb issues. Yeah,
I can throw out a little trick that was taught to me really early on. Mm-hmm. When it comes to tailoring an interesting reverb sound. If you have the right kind of reverbs that let you split the or turn down one or the other, the early reflections from the tail of the reverb, to use one reverb that does early reflections, you know, the very room kind of sound, separately from another reverb that's good at nice, smooth tails, and mix them against each other and create your own, you know, hybrid reverb between the two. Hmm. That way you can tune a little more room sound, not as much as that sloshy, you know, long tail, but you can balance those two together and get the effect of both without having it be overwhelming or everything, you know, just be in reverb soup.
Cool. Mm. Would that be chained or on separate tracks, separate FX returns?
It could be. It would probably make it easier to balance the two if you had it on two buses,
right?
Rather than feeding them into each other. But once you found something, like I have an area, a range that I find works most of the time. So a lot of times I'll just build that reverb as two plugins on one bus, and use the wet dry controls to do the blend.
Do any of you guys think about tempo of the song when picking a reverb? Like how how long the reverb tail is, you know, that makes an effect on the song. Mm. Is that something you think about?
Sure. In a general way, yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
I typically want
tail. In general, you know, quicker tempo songs of, you know, generally shorter reverbs, and ballads, obviously, kind of longer tails. But beyond that, I think it's just kind of a rule of thumb, you know, and that what feels right.
It's all about feel.
I try to get the tail from the first snare hit at the beginning of the first chorus. I want the tail to be gone by the end of the song, usually.
That's a good rule of thumb.
At least by the end, yes. Right.
So, yeah, so somewhere around 3 minutes.
Hopefully.
Yeah. You know, you gotta use moderation here. All right.
Charles Dye brought up an interesting point about that in Mix It Like a Record, basically saying that the reverb on your snare is the overall key to the ear in the song of where the back wall of your space is. So you're setting the tone of your entire mix by what you put on the snare.
Mm. Right. Profound.
Where's my gong?
Where's my gong?
Charles always does that, though. For me, at least. Say something simple and then makes you think for a week.
Blows your mind.
Let's see. Nathan asks, what preamps do you guys use and why? Or maybe top preamp or two.
True Systems P Solo. By far, best preamp for under $1,000.
That's the next one.
If you're looking
list,
for Super Clean,
it is tasty.
Ditto so far.
I like a little more color in my preamps. Right now I'm using
John Hardy M1.
That's a nice one too. That's one of the next ones on my list too. But the I like the Neve sound. I like the transformer based preamp kind of vibe. A little more color, a little more flavor.
Mm. I'm a little bit more vanilla. I tend to use mostly Millennia HV3D. I have a bunch of Focusrite pre's both on the Control 24 and the Octa pre as well, which I only use if I'm really running out of channels. A couple of Grace designs, M101s, four channels of that, and then like an Aphex, Tube Essence or something like that. If I really need something very specific, I have Dream Hire down the street, so I rent, you know, if somebody says, you have to use an Avalon for this project, then okay, fine. I just rent it. I'm considering looking for something else, maybe a tube or a solid state, I mean a transformer-based pre. Just, I'm always looking for something new, aren't I, Big Al?
And Slough has been fueling my gear lust for a while, too.
Slough can tell you, can bet if he's not, I'll bring something up to make sure he is.
Yeah.
It's a vicious circle with this whole group.
It is.
Hey, you know, I could recommend a pre that I thought was really good that you can get new it's $500-$600, but you can also find them in great shape used on, you know, like Craigslist and eBay, and that is the Presonus Eureka. About $350 on the used market, and that is a fantastic pre for in the $300 to $400 range, even in used gear.
Yeah,
that's a wonderful pre.
That has the EQ on it too, doesn't it?
And compression.
Yeah, EQ and comp. Yeah, it's like a little channel strip.
Yeah,
looks like a mini Avalon really 737 in your strip. Rack, so it looks cool.
And I've heard there's a
razzle dazzle factor.
I've heard a lot of folks doing some. I don't know who does it, but a mod on the transformer that really sounds amazing on it.
Yeah, they put a Jensen in it and pop what's out in there out. But it's just stock sounds pretty darn good.
And that should be a fairly easy mod, too. It's just a couple wires here and there with transformers. They're big pieces, so it's not the hardest mods in the world.
And Ryan, you should elaborate on what you meant about a color pre and the pricing and what you're talking about and how easy it is and affordable to get what it is you're talking about.
Well, I'm using the Golden Age Pre-73, which is a Neve clone made by a Swedish company that ships all this stuff out to China. And these ones are also easily moddable. A lot of people swap out the input and output transformers and a lot of the caps and things to make them exactly like the Neves. But this one is it's stock, and I use it a lot. It just has a real punchy mid character that makes vocals and electric guitars and bass just really stand out of the mix without even trying. No EQ on this, so it's just like the front end preamp section. But for $350, you can get something that sounds pretty similar. And if you hear them side by side, they're ballpark. You can really only tell the difference apart when they are exactly side by side. But this one goes for $350-ish, I think maybe $299. And then if you want to buy the actual Neve 1073, you're looking at about $3,500 for a used unit.
Wow.
Yeah, I listened to that podcast.
There are a bunch of... Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
If you guys go to the home recording show a couple shows back, Ryan did a review of that. And you were like the perfect salesman. You did this whole review, and I'm thinking, that sounds great, but I won't be able to afford it. And then he popped out the price at the end. I mean, it's a great...
Right. Yeah, and certainly no one was paying me for that. That was just because I was that happy.
I know. It was very convincing. It's, I mean, real exciting to listen to.
I did actually got a lot of emails. People went to Zen Pro Audio, where I got it from, and bought a bunch and said, I heard Ryan on the show talk about it. I was on the fence, and now I got it. So I actually sold a few units, so we'll be expecting that check-in anytime.
Cha-ching. Guys, go buy the Great River... NV1. No, never mind. Go ahead. Sorry.
And now a word from our sponsors. I only use the double. I'm kidding. Let's see. Everybody gotten their word in on preamps?
Tube preamps are cool too.
Yeah, I'd love to get like the PreSonus ADL 600 at some point. It does sound nice.
The average
actually have an old
Pre is not great.
No.
They just add noise. So for under $500, go
Rolls two channel Pre.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, yeah, that's usually a good idea. But I have a two channel Rolls. It's a RP220. It's a tube pre, and it's got basically like guitar strat knobs in the front of it for the gain and volume, and it sounds really good and has a DI input, which is really nice on bass, and I've been happy with it. And I bought it used for about, I think, $100.
Somebody here,
I don't know how many of them are out there still. That's one thing I'm not sure.
Somebody's asking about using clean pre's versus colored, as far as they're thinking about getting a set of, I think, a mixing board with a lot of clean, very good clean preamps. What do you guys think about, you know, if you, most of us have, you know, one or two pre's, if you had to get one, would you opt for clean over colored? Because you never know if that color is going to be right for the instrument.
Depends what you're primarily recording. Mm-hmm. If you're going to be doing more acoustic instruments, I would certainly go with a clean preamp. If you're going to be doing a lot more vocals or electric guitars and bass, I would go with a colored preamp more often. But that's all a matter of taste as well.
Yeah, it really is. It really depends what you are recording, like Ryan said. These days it's so easy to affect the sound after the fact and kind of get what you want, if you want sort of like an analog channel tube saturation kind of thing. I mean, there are a bunch of plugins out there that you can use to get that. That's a tough question to answer, because, you know, when somebody's starting out, you know, a person might not know exactly. I mean, they might not know, well, what is it that I'm going to record ultimately? I mean, you know, if they're recording stuff for themselves, all right, well, that's one question which they might be able to answer. But if they're thinking of having a home studio where they're recording other people, you never know what direction it's going to take. I certainly didn't know that I was going to end up recording jazz mostly and classical music, and it turns out that for that I really needed to go with transparent pre's, but if you're doing rock and roll, that's not necessarily the best way to go.
Yeah, just take a listen to, think about what music you listen to the most and what those sounds are. If you listen to classic rock all the time, you're probably going to want to go more towards a tube or a transformer-based pre. If you listen to a lot of classical or jazz or really clean-sounding tones, then you probably want to go clean.
Yeah.
Or just buy lots of pre's.
Yeah, just buy a ton of pre's. Break out the credit card.
One of the things that, you know, these days has become especially popular is going with like an API, like a 500 series, rack where you might have, there are many different types. And if you look in any of the magazines these days, there are tons of reviews of these all, these new, small modules that you could put in. You buy like a 6, 7, 8 space 500 series box, and you don't have to fill it up. I mean, you could start off with one or two channels of something. You could get like an API, 512, or am I thinking of the Portico now? The numbers just escape me. But Purple Audio makes them, Shiny Box makes them, Chandler.
Grace and True make them that too.
Grace does. Oh yeah, yeah, right. Grace as well.
And True just came out with a 500. Right, True,
this
does,
I mean, like everybody's doing this because, you get this one essentially rack mount item
power
that
supplies
power, right? Yeah. So now you're only buying these little modules, and if you're not completely thrilled with it, turn around and sell it. It's quite cost effective if you're looking at doing something. If you're looking at buying something that you can grow with, that can grow with you, I should say, and if you're looking at long term, it's kind of the same idea of like a keyboard player getting into buying modules rather than keyboards all the time. You buy a controller, and now you buy modules, and you sort of experiment that way. It's the same kind of concept, I guess.
And you might want to go in pairs too, so you can record in stereo.
Yeah, that's always a good idea. That's why I always buy two mics.
Yeah, jack up the price twice as much.
It does make it very cost effective, really. I mean, in the long run, yes, you do make that initial investment, but again, if you're going to be buying a pre or two channels of something, in the long run, you're going to be paying less. The more you buy, the more you save.
let me add one little point to think about. If you're really limited and you can only buy one or two things, or one type, I would say that there's ways to add color after the fact in some ways, and that having color going in, it's like, once you ring the bell, you can't unring it.
You've baked it in, yeah.
Yeah, so there's something to think about there, too. Like, how much more flexibility will I have? If I have it clean, I can always dirty it up.
Good
opposed
point.
To, I can't get rid of it once I'm stuck.
It's kind of the same idea for folks who think they really want to get a channel strip with EQ and compression, but in the heat of the moment, you may squash the crap out of it. And then
yeah, definitely light compression at tracking, not heavy compression. And yeah, watch your EQ because you get a lot of trouble there.
There you go. There's another thing that's changed fundamentally, like going back to your first question, Joe, when you said like what was a transforming moment and stuff. I used to do live jazz recordings where I was doing everything. I was mixing everything live, and everything was EQ'd and compressed going in, And I mean, I would often do two-track mixes live. It wasn't even multi-track sometimes.
The year was 1945.
Yeah, me and Sweetie, and we were sitting there in my day.
But I got used to the idea of tracking with no compression, and I don't track with compression. I haven't for years. Everything I do is like just totally, totally uncompressed, no EQ. If I put EQ on something, that's like, that's unusual,
That's definitely my jazz first mentality.
Wait. So you get it right at the source? What's that all about?
What a concept, right? Absolutely.
Quite odd.
Absolutely.
I'll just fix it in the mix.
Yeah, and that of course we all for. Know. Yeah, we all know that is a bad attitude to have. Yeah. is to think that you're going to fix it in the mix. If something doesn't sound right, you go out there, you adjust the microphones, you listen back, you change the microphones, you change the position, you change the position of the performer. I mean, you know, and in addition to that, like I'm saying, I don't track with compression. Just because these days there's little need for it. I would say certainly in a mixing situation, I always apply compression. I shouldn't say always. If it's a jazz session, I might not. But I mean, if we're talking about pop production, rock kind of, you know, tunes, I would say 99% of the tracks are going to have some compression on them, but I mean that's the kind of thing that you could always do later, because I mean these days we're dealing with such enormous dynamic ranges of things, and yeah, you need to tame it, but you know, going in, I would say it's not a necessity. If you're confident, and sure, why not, you know, even out the performance a little bit going in, a couple of decibels or whatever, but again, like Big Al said, that's already baked in. You're not going to undo that, you know. So you got to be kind of a little bit careful.
But some compressors do have a cool sound, and you might want to add that to your sound.
Oh, sure.
And if you know what you want up front, then you track it and you live with it.
And that's the key, though. It's knowing what you want. And I guess you know, early on, people are a little bit less certain. I mean, you know, back when you had four tracks to work with, and that was it, or you had eight tracks, you made decisions on the fly, and you lived with it, and that was the way you did it. I mean, you know, Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, the latest album, they went from 16 tracks down to 8, because they said, you know what, we want to limit our options, because that made for a better product, because they were forced to say, you know what, we're going to record this together, we're going to record this guitar and that horn together on the same track. And you
that
make
brings
your
up a
choices.
Great point. Yeah, to visualize what you're going to do, even though we have infinite options, visualize what you're going to do and try to get that and as simply as possible. You'll probably get better results than, you know, trying to multi-track it to death.
Sure. Sure. Because otherwise, these days, it's so easy to get option paralysis. The tendency when given too many options or too many choices not to make one. And,
yep.
You know, again, it's a different world. And I mean, I still, you know, even though I have, like, on the HD system, it's like, what is it, 128, 256 tracks? No, it's 128 tracks, I guess. I've mixed big projects, but, like, anything that I've ever done of my own, it's like I never think about, you know, like, oh, I'll add another thing, and I'll add another thing. To me, it's all about saying, yeah, right, you have the room, but to me, it's all about saying what you can say, and, well, just like lyrics, just like an economy of lyrics, say what you have to say as clearly, as concisely, and with as few words as possible. And to me, that's what music is. You know, if you could say it with three instruments, with guitar, bass, drums, that's all it needs. Why throw yet another keyboard on there and a thing and then a, you know, a cowbell?
There it is.
I mean, it's like
more cowbell.
You don't need an excuse ever for more
just
cowbell.
Just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Unless it's cowbell.
That's right. Just do it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's look, I think we'd all agree it's all about the song. It's all about, and let's assume we're talking about music, because you know, some people are recording, you know, voiceovers or whatever, so it's not music, but let's assume that we're talking about songs, which is, you know, 99% of what we all do. It's all about the song, the vocal, telling that story, the emotional impact, how it moves you. And that's the ultimate, that's the bottom line. I mean, and you know, I have to say, I really have a love-hate relationship with gear. I really, really honestly do. You guys all know that I will salivate over microphones, and that gets disgusting, I know. But, you know, at the same time, to me, it's like, who cares? It doesn't matter whether you're putting a 57 on an amp, or whether you're putting a U47 on it, or whether it's a ribbon. It totally doesn't matter. It's all about the end result, how it hits you and how it hits the listener. If something is distracting, that's not good. You know, it's like things should be made to sound exactly how they need to be. And that's the key, isn't it? To know what you need or what the song needs. And that's something that you can't teach that. You know, that's something that you can learn. You could certainly learn, but it's not going to hit everybody in the same way. Everybody's going to have that aha moment. And that might not be even one single moment. It could be over the course of months or years where they kind of get it and they understand.
It's also something you can work on without a single piece of gear. Just visualize it in your mind's eye.
And listening to other things and saying, wow, listen to how that particular recording sounds, or what the guitar sounds like in that recording, or how the vocal sits, or how the backing vocals sound, or whatever it is, you know, whatever element you're talking about.
Speaking of economy of words, I'll give you one word for all of it. Mm-hmm. Arrangement.
Mm.
Now, there's a lot of people that buy
good
gear,
one.
buy gear, and we get, you know, really deep into the technical aspects of things, and lots of people, you know, right, want to throw down their guitar and a bass, but a lot of times I think people are skipping past the educating themselves musically. Arranging is a talent, and can be every bit as important as the song, because a lot of times you hear a great song, and as you were saying, they knew how that was going to be. It wasn't the mix that did it. It was because I know the range that... It's like a good classical composer will use the sections of the orchestra and you know, the frequency range that they occupy to make a certain point. It's not that he expected some mixing engineer later to turn the strings into something. I know if I use violas, I'm going to get this sound and this feeling and this emotion. Before I even perform it, I know in my head I got this scape in mind. So just like, you know, Ryan was saying about visualizing it, that's part of the arrangement of how should it sound, and let's have an idea of what it's going to be and how it all works, instead of just recording as much as we can and sorting it out in the mix.
Right. I would even broaden that, though. I mean, arrangement is absolutely critical. I would take it a step further and broaden it to the word production. And I think that within that broader umbrella is the knowledge of whether an arrangement is working or not. You know, is this right? Is this the right approach for a song, etc. In a grand scheme, and arranging is a huge part of that. You know, as much as orchestration is, as much as performances. You know, being able to say, you know, to someone, you know, or knowing whether a person could get a better, could do a better performance, whether they're in the zone or not. You know, there's so many elements to it. And depending on whether you're working on your own stuff or sort of working on other people's things, producing it or, as opposed to engineering, very broad subjects. I mean, we're covering like really broad range of you know, topics, A to Z, really.
Did we start talking about microphones here?
Did someone say microphone?
Is that where it started? I don't even remember where we started anymore.
That's because I don't have an economy of words. I'm willy-nilly all over the place.
I just saw a rabbit go by me.
What?
We've gone down the rabbit hole.
Oh, rabbit hole.
Big ass.
Our apologies, Joe.
No, I get to just sit back and play solitaire, so that's awesome. I keyed. So let's see, I got a couple questions here. Let's redirect. There's one here about stereo recordings. What do you guys talk about using just two mics for recording, you know, two mics, one room, whether it's, I've got actually a podcast coming up this Friday with a friend of mine who all the drums on his album were two very different mics. And he just messed around with placement and things to get the sound he wanted. What do you guys think? Do you do that a lot? And what pointers can you give us?
Use good gear.
Use good
if you have to.
Arrangement.
It's not that expensive to rent some decent mics and preamps and just I don't know.
But you also have to think, are you going for stereo? Or you had mentioned there's two different mics. So with two different mics, you're not really going for a true stereo.
Right.
If you want stereo, you want to go with two identical mics and, better yet, a matched pair and then identical preamps and all that stuff. But if you're just using two different mics, then you're talking about two different placements and maybe even a mono recording with two sources.
Yeah, you might just want to choose one of them for kick and one just overhead capturing the whole kit. I mean, a lot of people just do that. I mean, a lot of Beatles recordings were one
Ringo
mic
style
on a kick, and a Coles 4038 about 4 feet above the snare, and that was it. One thing about stereo drum miking, I mean, you know, this is a matter of taste and preference. Like some people really like to really get this super wide feeling on the drums where you have a tom coming out of the left speaker and a tom, you know, floor tom out of the right or whatever. That's also a stylistic choice that, you know, I mean, some people dig that and some people just say like, ugh, you know.
We can tell what side you're on, by the way.
You think? I like both. I like both, but no, I'm not the wide. I'm not the kind of sort of, you know, you're sitting on the kick drum between the two toms.
Yeah.
Was the person asking the question referring specifically to drums or overall recording?
I assume drums. It didn't say, but I think all in all, I mean, I think it's a good exercise to, you know, to have, like we've talked about, limiting yourself. Because if you're just going to use two mics, then you make yourself have to listen to it a little more intently as you're setting up the mics and finding that right placement. And
phase issue is a monster.
Yeah.
I'd probably use like...
Well, I think an important part of doing a stereo recording...
And that lag is killer.
Yeah, I think Jesse's got the most delay.
Let me pull up.
I just thought he was deep in thought.
I thought that was a dramatic pause.
Yeah, me too.
I would probably do a pair of Omni mics, like 414s in Omni, and doing a whole band in a room with just two Omnis, something like that.
Yeah, Omnis will give you a bigger, wider kind of feel in general than two cardioids will.
Yeah, and whenever you're doing anything in stereo, it's always good to sum them into mono to make sure you don't have phasing issues. This is, you could hear it more readily, because if you don't sum them to mono, it will not be apparent to you that there's a problem. If you sum them to mono and you feel that it's a bit anemic and it suddenly loses power in the low end and suddenly it's very thin sounding, then you clearly have a phase issue.
And then do we fix it in the mix or walk in the room and grab the mics?
There you go.
Walk in the room and grab those mics.
Always, yeah.
That's right. That's right. And it's really worth spending. I mean, that is something that really is worth spending time on. And unfortunately, you know, when you're under pressure, and if you're, you know, in the middle of a session, like the last thing you want to do is really take time. But it is absolutely worth every minute that you spend getting it right.
And it always saves you time on the back end, because you may be getting to recording quicker, but you're going to be mixing for a lot longer.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Just on the general topic of recording, I know some people who, if the band is good and the band knows how to balance themselves, they have gotten amazing recordings of a band with just like a Zoom H4.
Yeah.
With its stereo set of mics that are built in. And nothing else, and had it sound really nice. So you don't have to have, you know, stacks and pallets of kit in order to get a good stereo recording.
Yeah. One trick also in terms of if you're in a venue and you're recording and you do have the luxury of positioning the mics wherever you want to, and I'm not talking about like a bar where there are going to be, you know, a couple of hundred people walking around the microphones necessarily. I'm talking about if you're doing a recording, let's say, if you're doing a choral thing or something like that, or just even a band or whatever, and you want to get a nice balance between, and assuming you're only dealing with like a stereo, like an H2, like Big Al said, one of the tricks that I've learned from another engineer was to stand toward the front of the place where the band is playing or where the choir is singing or whatever it is, whatever the sound source is, and then slowly walk backwards until you essentially hear about a sudden rise in volume, which will be roughly 3 decibels, which is roughly where the band's volume or the sound source's volume and the room's volume are equal, because you'll have a doubling of the power at that point. And at that point, you just want to step back toward the source and just plant your recorder there or your microphones there, and you'll get a very nice balance in terms of direct and ambient sound. That's just a little
good tip
for those stereo recordists out there.
And that'll also work with the room with a band, too, to a lesser degree, because it'd be a lot less room noise, more direct sound, but it'll help you place your mics. Mm-hmm. Got to find the right location for those microphones.
That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. Rudy Van Gelder used to go out and spend like a ton of time just walking around while, people like Coltrane were, just playing. And he'd just walk around, and he'd place 2 microphones. That's it. And he might spend an hour walking around, but once he
do
once
it right,
he got that position,
all you need.
That's yeah, and that was it.
As a resource for some other interesting methods of picking mic locations like that, highly recommend the book Mixing with Your Mind. It's loaded with those kind of interesting shortcuts.
Mm. Nice.
Mixing with Your Mind. Let's see.
By Stavros, another one named guy like Slough.
Stavros.
All right, one question here. Says his bass tracks are inconsistent. He uses compression, but the lower notes come through, and then the higher bass notes seem to disappear. Any tips?
It's the bass.
Now, can that be further clarified as to whether it's disappearing in the mix itself, or is it disappearing in the room where he's monitoring?
That's an
excellent
question.
Compression will take down your highs a little bit too. When you use extreme compression, you'll definitely lose some of the high end, so you have to add that back with EQ.
It's in the mix. He's saying, and let's assume maybe it wasn't a really consistent performance. Now, I know we could all say get a better performance, but let's just say it's as good as it's going to get, and some of the notes are being lost. What do you guys do there? Automation, more compression, multiband compression?
Well, I would take one off the amp and one off the DI and use both signal sources, so you'll have probably more of your high end coming directly from your DI, and then you definitely compress to taste, or even use some parallel compression to get some of the natural of what he liked of the track to come through on one track, and then compress the other one heavily and put them side by side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would also automate if necessary if there's critical parts, or even after all of that you don't want to overcompress and you're still missing, a nice little run that was done on the upper register or whatever. I just automate it and bring it in.
Yeah,
high notes on bass. Who needs them?
Just grab a guitar.
It's like low notes on the cymbal.
But elaborate on what Slough was saying too. Let's say that while they were tracking, they didn't notice it until they got to mix time, or it sounded fine when they were playing and there's mix time. Then I'm thinking also about environment. If you've got some really nasty mode rejection or half-axis rejection going on in your room. And you're not able to hear those problems until you play it back, right. or the low end is exaggerated because of a node in the room, and you're not even hearing it accurately because of your surroundings. That right. can play havoc with your monitoring, or even when you're playing, and because you'll play harder into something because it sounds like it's disappearing, but in reality it's not. That all comes back to proper room treatment.
Excellent point. Yeah, check to see if you're having the same problem. Check it in the car, check it on a home stereo, check it in headphones to see if you're trying to do all this processing on something that isn't broken. It's just the room
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And one of the things that just really that I love about working on audio is the fact that while there are general sort of pointers that or general, let's say, you know, guidelines for all of this stuff, you know, which we can all agree on, certainly, every instance, you know, has its own challenges and its own unique, you know, situations, you know, its own problems. And I think that's the whole fun in it, is listening to something, and no two bass recordings are going to be alike. And, you know, and I think that the fun is in figuring out what will make this better, what will make this work. It's a little puzzle, and that's what I love about it.
You know? I think that's why it's important, too, not to just reach for, you know, X setting on X compressor because that worked before. You know, right. Like you said, that did work one time, and it may never work mm-hmm. again.
It could be and the for key. Bass. You could be the key your song's in.
It could be.
Yeah.
But I also to run bass through tube amps and push the tube amps a little hard and then run that alongside of a clean DI. And that'll give you some pretty good results, give you some character there, and then give you the nice clean off the highs. I like one dirty and one clean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think these days there's almost no excuse for you know, not recording a bass or a guitar with a clean DI and then, you know, recording an amp signal as well if you want, but having the option to reamp it or put a plug-in on it, whatever. And, you know, that may sound counterintuitive to what I said before about making decisions.
You got 128 tracks.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm all for making decisions, believe me. I'm, you know, the less I have to think about something, the better, you know. But having that option is an insurance policy, and there's nothing wrong with having an insurance policy. You know, and having that backup doesn't mean you have to use it, but, you know, when you
And just
need
so
it,
we're clear, when we're talking about that, for those of you that don't know, it's just using a DI box that basically splits the signal. You can send the signal back out the quarter inch out into your amp, but it also takes a balanced signal that you can record the direct signal as well.
So you open up two tracks on your DAW, and one will be off your amp with your microphone like normal, and then one will be directly from the instrument.
Mm-hmm. And usually the DI is muted. Like if it's guitar, usually while you're recording.
Especially if it's guitar, it just sounds awful.
Muted and hidden so he doesn't know.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you're going to mix them together, it doesn't hurt to check delay or phase on those two tracks as well.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see.
Is next, swimwear.
We'll do a couple more questions and we'll call it a night because it's getting late.
Joel,
for
I just want to say that. I just want to tell you, just say thank you for having us on. I unfortunately have to bow out to another appointment this evening, but it's been a great fun. And everybody out there listening, you know, don't give up. You're all on the same road at different speeds, and we all improve every day and have our own aha moments over and over again. So just keep at it.
Well, Big Al, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, great everyone. To have
you. Talk to you later, Biggs.
Bye, Big Al.
Maybe we could play some outro music, or he could play his. There it is. All right, there's a couple more here. Speaker placement, I guess, studio monitor placement in particular. What
there is kind of one way.
The right way.
The right way. Yeah. All right. Next question.
It's my way.
Moving on.
All right.
It ultimately depends on your room. And if you have a square room, a perfect square,
then
you're
move.
Pretty much, there's no good place to put your speakers. If you have a room with the long dimension, that's where you want your speakers to be facing and shooting into the long dimension, not the shorter dimension of the room. Generally, and throw up a couple baffles and try to find where the reflections might be weird or corners or a lot of bare walls. Try to put up some baffles, some acoustic panels, that kind of thing. But you know, as long as the dimensions of your room aren't against you from the get-go, you can get pretty good results by throwing up a couple furniture pads and just shooting into the long dimension of the room.
And do everything you can to make them centered on the wall, so one's not closer to a corner than the other. Or yep. Your base response on
and
one's
away from
be
the wall.
Yeah,
and away from the wall, mm-hmm. Right?
And then also decoupled from
your mopeds. Yeah,
there you go.
Orlex mopeds are the best.
Either put them on stands or on pads. Yeah. Another thing that I think is important, and again, it depends on kind of like where you are in the sort of journey in terms of, buying gear and stuff like that. If, you know, it might not be a big deal when you're starting out, but these days, since equipment is so cheap and you could get pretty powerful stuff, one thing to consider also is what your monitors are meant, or actually what kind of cubic volume your monitors are meant to fill. Just because you could afford to buy Genelec 1031s or whatever these days is like the 8050As, it doesn't mean that those are the best for your room, because speakers, you know, have a particular power rating, and they're meant to work most efficiently at a particular sound level. When I was buying monitors some years ago, I was thinking of sort of getting the biggest and, you know, the top of the line model at one point, and the manufacturer said to me, "Well, what's the size of your control room?" You know, and I said, "Well, yeah, it's a 14 by 16, this and that." And he says, "Oh, no. You don't want those." And I go, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah, no. Those speakers are way too big for that room. You want to get the model below that." And I thought, "Really? Does it make that much of a difference?" And you know, he just absolutely said categorically, for the volume of your room, the speakers are going to, this level below is going to work far better. And again, if you got a 10-foot by 10-foot room, I'm saying you don't want Mackie, you know, 824s. It's you're going to crank them up to one, and they're not going to work at their best at their maximum efficiency. So you're not going to get the benefit of those speakers. So that's something to consider, you know, if you're into buying gear, look into that. I mean, you know, into speakers specifically.
Kind of like playing a full Marshall stack at a coffee house or something.
Pretty much. I guess it's the same. You know, you're gonna crank it to one. Are you gonna get any sort of, well, that's an exaggerated, I mean, that's an extreme example, but yeah. Are
you gonna, I work by sound, I see it all the time. You'd be surprised.
Okay. Well, there you go. You know, but are you gonna open that amp to its full tilt so that you could get a nice crunch and sustain? No. You're gonna put it up to two and it's gonna be deafening, you know? So yeah, you wanna get something that's appropriate.
Definitely.
The average home studio is just too small for 8-inch speakers in general.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like right.
Yeah.
There's no shame in 5 and 6-inch woofers.
No, absolutely.
All right. Let's see here. Here's an EQ question. Talking about removing unwanted ring in toms by doing a narrow, you know, a narrow Q, boosting it, finding the frequency, and then cutting it. Asking about if that's okay for vocals, and any other suggestions for subtractive EQ. Because first off, I would say definitely cut before you boost. So often you see everybody boost a little bit of lows, then the highs, and then the mids, and then more lows, then highs, then mids, and then next thing you know, you've added a lot more sound that doesn't need to be there.
Right.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of taking away before I add.
Of course. But there is the sort of the technique of boosting first in order to find the offending frequency in a very narrow band, you know, in a very narrow Q.
Absolutely.
You know, you sweep, you create a very narrow Q, you sweep, and then you find that honker, you know, that is really the offending frequency, and then you widen the Q a little bit, and then you cut. So that's one technique. Doing it for a vocal, absolutely, if it's necessary. But again, you know, it depends on what hardware you're using or what plugin you're using. You know, equalization introduces phase shifting. So you can get yourself into a situation where if you're boosting one, I'm sorry, cutting one frequency a couple of decibels, all right, fine. But if you're doing it at a couple of frequencies and you're cutting sort of 8, 10, 12 decibels, you might find that it's going to kind of adversely affect that vocal.
And that's the thing, too, where you might find that moving the mic during tracking will take away the need to have to. So that's another excellent example of moving your mic or maybe moving your singer just a little further back from the mic to not pick up that frequency in the first place and then not have to worry about phase issues, EQing, and especially sure. Jesse's cat, Tom, in the background there.
Yes.
No, and in terms of vocal recording specifically and proximity effect, and most people are going to be using microphones in a cardioid pattern almost all the time. And the thing is, you know, proximity effect really starts to exhibit itself, and depending on the microphone, of course, but if you are in a cardioid pattern, you know, people are singing 6 inches, 4 inches away, 6 inches away from a microphone. You're going to have a ton of proximity effect on that vocal. If at all possible, I would strongly recommend anyone recording vocals to try, if at all possible, to record their vocals at sort of like 12 inches away, maybe, you know, a little bit more maybe, if you can afford it in terms of your room sound. You know, one quick and dirty way to sort of eliminate reflections, if you don't have that much treatment, is to sing, you know, open up a closet filled with clothing, stand in front of the closet, face the microphone toward the closet. You know, that'll help in terms of, you know, reflections and stuff. But you'll get a more even performance. Think about the you know, the inverse square law, where if you have the distance to a source, you're going to increase the volume by 6 decibels, and the reverse is true. So if you're standing 4 inches from a microphone and you move forward just 2 inches, which is easy to do if you're into it, you know, and you're singing, that is going to suddenly boost 6 decibels. All right, and if you think of backing off from the mic to a distance of 12 inches, moving 2 inches forward is not going to increase it hardly at all. You'd have to go 6 full inches to increase 6 decibels, but you have room to go back. The farther back you go, obviously, the less it's going to make a difference how much you move. And again, it's all for getting a consistent performance.
It'll also make you think more about fractions, too.
Sly will be giving a test at the end of this. I'm trying to remember back to the move the mic far away and then move back closer.
Okay, now frequency over wavelength equal. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
There it is.
Sorry.
The speed of sound divided by
wavelength. Square root of pi.
There it is.
Plus 4.
Minus 10. All right. I think there was one more here. This is maybe a decent one to end on, just talking about mixing. Talking about a rock tune, asking if you're using some sort of frequency spectrum analyzer just on your entire mix, do you ever use that to kind of visually check kind of how the balance is in your mix across the frequencies? And is there something you kind of hope to see there when your mix is done? Do you use that at all? Do you guys analyze your mixes or use that? I tend to not, because I just don't really know how to read them very in any way.
I go by ears mainly. Yeah, I go by ears mainly. That's the way I've learned it. So that's the way I go with it.
I think the only time I found it useful is if I was mixing on smaller monitors that don't reproduce down in 30, 40 hertz and can at least see if there's something going on down there visually. But obviously checking that on a bigger system is the ideal solution.
Yeah.
I do nothing visually. As a lot of people know, I'm visually impaired. I'm legally blind. So I don't rely on any of that stuff. And frankly, you know, a lot of engineers will a lot of sighted engineers will tell you, you know, whenever they're working on stuff with clients, they'll reach over and turn off the monitor because it's a huge distraction. We're dealing with audio. We're not dealing with looking at waveforms. Yes, there is a time when it's really helpful to do that, of course, but it's a huge distraction a lot of the time, and you know, I clearly don't for obvious reasons I don't rely on it, but to me, I don't miss it. Put it that way.
Yeah.
Occasionally, I'll look at a phase scope if I'm if I'm doing something really weird where, you know, I'm going beyond the speakers and stuff. I just want to make sure that it's still good. Or if I've recorded something or I've gotten something from someone else and sounding kind of weird, I'll check it on the phase scope just to make sure that, yes, it's phase that's the problem, not something else. Right. So, and then as far as frequency analyzers, not really. Unless there's... If there's an EQ that has an analyzer, sometimes I'll look at it, but I don't use it specifically. I can use an EQ whether it has an analyzer built in or not.
I find I almost don't like using graphic EQs lately. I'm so tempted to just do what looks pretty or what looks like it should work, and then
all smiley face.
the Bose curve, but I've used the SSL plugins a lot. And I mean, obviously they do sound good, but the fact that there is no visual graphic EQ is kind of nice. It just makes you listen.
Yeah. The thing with EQs where you can see you may not be able to see the waveform, but you can see frequency and the curve and how much gain added or reduced. It feels like you kind of go into what you used last time, you kind of do a certain thing each time you bring it up.
Yep.
And when you start going into that visual side of your brain and you stop listening and you start looking and you can lose track pretty easily. I stay away from them for the most part.
I think the worst is compression. I try to do, okay, I want it to knock off this many dB just because that's what someone told me once. And we're at
First you have to learn the rules, and then you have to learn not to use the rules.
Yeah, exactly. But very cool.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, awesome. Well, I don't want to keep you guys. We have covered a lot, and certainly there are more things to cover. Maybe we'll do this again one day. But
I'll be here.
Awesome.
Sure.
Well,
and thanks again for inviting us, Joe. And I hope that that some of what we said, you know, might have helped some people or helped clarify things. And I'm sure that if anybody has, questions, they could certainly, email us or email us through you or whatever. And I'm sure that we'd all be happy to clarify something that we might have said or something like that.
Because that's what we do.
Absolutely.
That's what we do.
So you guys just follow. I've got links to everybody's websites on Home Studio Corner if you don't know them already. So and they all have ways to contact them there. So you guys can't see this, but I'm getting a ton of thank yous from everybody.
Well, thank everyone for showing up.
Yeah, thank you guys. We had
fun.
We had 71 folks make it through to the end. So kudos to everyone. So if you guys aren't already subscribed to all of these guys, websites, podcasts, etc., make sure you do, because they're always putting out fun stuff. They're always putting out. Okay.
All right.
There it is. Cool. Well, thank you guys again. I think we're going to bring this one to a close, and the Predators lost to Chicago. Stink.
Oh.
Yeah, they're out. Now I'm sad again. Cool.
What sport is that?
That would be hockey. Playoffs. So anyway, I had a spy watching the game and attending the webinar at the same time. Excellent. Cool.
That's why you let Slough talk for so long.
Oh, I left the room for about 5 minutes there. Thank you guys again. We are going to call this a night.
All right, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Right. Thank you.
Cheers. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
See you. Bye.
All right.